We want to welcome students from Mount Horeb High School. Will they please stand? And their teachers and their guests. And anyone else with them. Congratulated for coming out, driving this far, joining us, and we thank you. You may be seated. The students are here with a national award-winning program entitled Court with Class. It's sponsored by the State Bar and the Supreme Court. And we invite students from across the state to come and listen to an oral argument. If they accept our invitation, then they are given materials about the case. They may engage in other activities relating to the case, come to the court, listen to oral argument, and then meet with a justice of the Supreme Court to discuss the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues of the case. So let me say thanks again for coming, and I will now introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Rogensack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. You will be meeting with Justice Bradley after this case. And to her right, Justice David Prosser. And on the far right, Justice Annette Siegler. I will now call our second case for the day and last case for the January oral arguments. 07-AP-79-CR, State versus Jennifer Ward. Representing Ms. Ward is Attorney Christopher Kelly. Mr. Kelly.
May it please the court, my name is Chris Kelly. I represent the petitioner, Jennifer Ward, in this appeal from a conviction of first-degree reckless homicide. The issues that we have raised on appeal arise out of an interrogation that took place over the course of 2 days, during which Ms. Ward was held incommunicado, unable to communicate with her husband or other family members, during which an interrogation that began while she was in the hospital having suffered what a deputy described as an apparent seizure that continued while she was in physical and emotional pain in the hospital that relied upon deceptive tactics in order to induce admissions from Ms. Ward and that continued after an overnight break during which Ms. Ward was told she could not make any telephone calls. The two issues that we have raised are first, whether the statements that Ms. Ward gave, which evolved so that they progressively became more incriminating as the interrogation continued, were made voluntarily, as the Due Process Clause of the United States and Wisconsin Constitutions require. And secondly, whether her waiver of counsel on the second day was voluntary, given that she was not allowed to contact counsel during the overnight break. Turning to the issue of voluntariness of the admissions that Ms. Ward gave, this court, I'm sure, is familiar with the standard. The court must look to the totality of the circumstances and must ask whether the police used coercive tactics in order to induce a confession or statements that exceeded the defendant's ability to resist those tactics, overcoming her free will and resulting in statements or a confession that was not voluntary. In order to do that, the court has to look both to the personal circumstances of the defendant and to the coercive tactics that are used by the interrogator. I think the The facts of this case are the sort of facts that classically lead to false confessions and therefore to wrongful convictions. We have a police detective, Detective Shapey, who immediately focused his investigation and his interrogation upon proving that Jennifer Ward was guilty, having done virtually no investigation. He simply had been dispatched to the hospital with news that a baby had been seriously injured. He had a brief discussion with a physician, and this is from the trial transcript, not from the suppression transcript, who, according to Detective Shapey, told him that the baby had a subdural hematoma. Detective Shapey concluded from his conversation with the physician that this was a shaken baby case, and from that moment forward, he devoted his interrogation to getting Jennifer Ward to admit that she had, in fact, done something to injure the child. He didn't conduct any other investigation. He didn't try to determine what all of the facts were before he focused all of his efforts on inducing that confession. If we take a look at the circumstances of Jennifer Ward, I think there are two facts that are particularly salient here. The first is that she had collapsed in her home after the baby was taken away in an ambulance. She was hysterical, and according to the testimony of the deputy who was there with her, she suffered from an apparent seizure. She was taken in an ambulance to the hospital, and once she was hospitalized, she repeatedly complained that she was in pain. She talked about her back pain. She talked about the fact that she was having headaches. Even more significant than the physical pain that she was feeling, I think, is the emotional pain that she was obviously undergoing. She refused to acknowledge the fact that the baby had died when her daughter talked to her about that fact, and the daughter told her that the baby had died. She said, "No, that's not true. We'll see little Thomas again." So this is a woman who has been obviously traumatized by the fact that a baby in her care has suddenly been rushed to the hospital, who is incapable of recognizing the fact or acknowledging the fact that the baby has died. We know from the physician's notes, which were introduced into evidence at the suppression hearing, that the physician who cared for her said that she was undergoing mental status changes. So I think what we have to conclude from those circumstances is that we're dealing with an interrogation subject who is particularly vulnerable to any coercive tactics that the police used.
At some point, when one of the officers was going to administer the Miranda warnings, didn't your client interrupt him and say it's not necessary because she was familiar with the Miranda warnings?
She did.
And in fact, she went on to say the Miranda warnings.
I think she recited some of the warnings, yeah.
All right. And some of that could have come with her prior, as a result of her prior contacts with law enforcement.
I don't think there's any evidence in the record that her prior contacts with law enforcement involved an interrogation. Everybody knows Miranda warnings who watches television. You can't watch Law and Order or CSI or any other television show without hearing Miranda warnings over and over.
And having no idea what her viewing habits are, I wouldn't hazard a guess there either. However, your client has had prior experience with law enforcement. What was that? Since you're talking about her other salient points, what was her prior experience with law enforcement before this day?
She was in a vehicular collision and was charged with homicide as a result of that collision.
What was the result of that?
I don't know that that's in the record. I believe she was...
Okay. If it's not in the record, then that's...
Okay. And there's certainly no evidence in the record to suggest that she was interrogated, that she had any experience with interrogation in that prior police contact.
Mr. Kelly, I see this case is on all fours with Moran versus Burbine. Is that U.S. Supreme Court case I'm thinking about? And State versus Hansen, which is a case we had. It said, U.S. Supreme Court said, hey,
it's true
that in that case, the family had a lawyer for the person who was being questioned, who was being held incommunicado by the police officers, which they have every right to do, right? That the lawyer said, I want to see my client. Right? And the cop said, not until we're done questioning. Right? She didn't hire you. You don't have to deal with that. And the Supreme Court said that doesn't violate the United States Constitution. Right? Obviously felt needed for police investigation. Right. And in Hansen, we had an opportunity to say, because the U.S. Supreme Court said, but you states don't have to do that under your state constitutions. You can require higher or different conduct by law enforcement, right? And you can say law enforcement shouldn't do that. If there's a lawyer out there wanting to see the client that's hired by the family, you have to tell the person. And in Hansen, we had that opportunity, right? We declined it. We in effect said, hey, we're following the U.S. Supreme Court. Police don't have to tell the accused. Just go right on questioning them, right?
Yes.
And as I read this case, there was a long time questioning, right? 2.5 hours or 2 hours the first day in the hospital.
Just at the hospital.
Yeah. But no doctor said, oh, you can't question this woman because she's really ill. And they dismissed her from the hospital, right?
She was discharged, yes.
And then they took her downtown. And they told her she's not under arrest, right? She could leave any time, right? She didn't have a car. I mean, that was a problem. But they told her she could, and she said, why are you doing that, right? All right. Now they take her to the police station, and they question her for about 2.5, 3 hours, right? We're up to 5 o'clock that day. And they tell her she could get a lawyer, right?
Yes.
They don't tell her a lawyer is waiting for her outside. They can tell she, and they give her the Miranda warnings. You hear them all the time on television, right?
Certainly do.
And she doesn't say, I want a lawyer now, does she?
No.
She doesn't unambiguously request a lawyer, which is required under our case law, right?
Right.
And she makes all sorts of statements. Right? And some of these are recorded, right?
I think they were all recorded.
They were all recorded. So we know that she wasn't abused, right? There was no beating.
She was physically tortured.
Pardon me? She wasn't not tortured. Okay. She could have bathroom breaks. There's no deprivation of sleep, no deprivation of water or food, right?
True.
All right. And they say, okay, you're now under arrest, and we're going to book you, right?
Yes.
And so she goes to bed in jail, right?
Yes.
And on the third day, what does she do? Does she ask for a lawyer? No. Does she ask for her family?
Yes.
Yeah, but first she asks for the cop, for the detective. She wants to talk to the detective, right? And talks to him, then they want the family, etc. What in all these facts, and there are many more that I have omitted, including even deception, which is perfectly okay in interrogation, too. The detective told her that her daughter said that she saw that the mother shook the baby, right? The daughter said, I saw the mother shake the baby in order to try and resuscitate it, but they didn't leave, they left out.
Right.
But deception interrogation doesn't invalidate interrogation.
Not
right?
Automatically.
Not automatically. It's a factor. Put them all together. Why isn't this case to directly under Hansen. Aren't you asking us to overturn Hansen?
No, I'm not, Your Honor.
Okay, why not?
I am not here to re-argue Hansen. I think.
But you'd like to, but I understand.
I don't like Hansen, but I'm not here to re-argue it. I think the key difference is that Ms. Ward, unlike Hansen, had specifically asked to have contact with her husband, with family members, and it specifically said that the reason she wanted to do that was to get assistance from somebody she knew and trusted about whether she should exercise her right to have counsel. My position as to why Ms. Ward's case is different from Hansen is that Ms. Ward, in order to make a free and intelligent decision about whether to respond to the detective's questions and whether to exercise her right to counsel, wanted to get advice, not from a lawyer, but from a trusted family member. She wanted to talk to her husband, and she said repeatedly to Detective Shapey, "I want to talk to my husband. I don't know if I should talk to you. I don't know if I should have a lawyer. I feel like if I get up and leave, you're going to hold that against me." So
we had a juvenile who said, "I want to see my mom." He didn't let him see his mom. They ultimately, I think in that case, Seventh Circuit found that that was not voluntary. But so every time somebody in custody says, "I want to see my mom," or "I want to see my husband," or "my daughter," or "my priest," is that going to mean you got to stop questioning them?
I think that it means if the interrogated subject says, "I can't decide whether I should waive my right to counsel without getting assistance from my husband, my father, whatever," that the law enforcement officer, absent some compelling reason to say you can't talk to that person, for instance, you know, that person is somebody who we think committed the crime with you and we don't want you to talk to that person so that you get your story straight. Absent those sorts of compelling circumstances, I don't think that the decision to waive counsel can be said to be free and voluntary when the person who's making that decision is being deprived of the information she needs in order to make a free and voluntary decision. She very expressly said, "I need to talk to my husband. I don't know if I should talk to you or not. I don't know if I need a lawyer or not. I rely upon my husband to assist me in making those kinds of decisions." I don't know how we can say that she's making an intelligent decision when she's being denied the resources that she thinks she needs in order to make an intelligent decision. And that distinguishes this case from Hansen, where nothing in the Hansen decision suggests that Hansen said, "I need to talk to somebody before I make a decision. I can't make this decision without talking to my wife, my father, whatever."
So in effect, the rule you're proposing would be an expansion of the constitutional right to counsel to the constitutional right to see the husband, see the neighbor, see the close friend, see the priest, see the relative with whom the person feels they need to consult before they decide whether or not to exercise their own individual rights.
I don't think it expands the rule at all. The rule of law right now is that the government bears a heavy burden of showing that a waiver of counsel was made knowingly, intelligently.
Then perhaps I misapprehend your response to the previous question, because the way I understood it is that under the rule you now urge upon this court, the questioning must cease until that person has the opportunity to consult with the individual that they've requested, absent, as you've left open, the avenue of some compelling reason, such as co-conspirators. But in essence, that is my understanding of the rule that you propose. If I'm incorrect, please take this opportunity to show me where.
Well, I think it depends upon the facts of the case. If a police officer is interrogating me, I think it is fair to assume that my understanding of the Miranda decision means that I don't have to consult with anybody. I'm fully capable of making an intelligent and knowing choice whether to exercise my right to counsel or not. But when you have somebody like Jennifer Ward, who has just been through a traumatic experience, and who is saying, I don't know what's best for me, I'm afraid that if I exercise my right, that's going to make it look like I'm guilty, I need more information before I make this decision. When the police deliberately deprive her of an opportunity to get that information, I think the record establishes in that factual scenario that she is not making an intelligent decision. Because
do you have any prior Wisconsin cases which hold to that effect?
I haven't seen a prior Wisconsin case that addresses this issue at all.
Okay. Do you have a case which indicates that the questioning must cease until the person has had the opportunity to consult with their husband or neighbor or someone else before deciding whether to exercise their constitutional right to counsel?
Not specifically, although my brief does cite a number of cases that talk about holding somebody incommunicado as being a factor that influences the voluntariness.
Right, which really doesn't go to the question of whether they have the constitutional right to consult with husband, neighbor, priest, or anybody else.
Again, I'm not suggesting that there's a constitutional right to consult. I'm saying there's a constitutional right to make an intelligent decision. And an individual who needs more information in order to make an intelligent decision and is denied the opportunity to get that information has been deprived of the right to make a knowing and intelligent decision whether to waive the right to counsel or not.
Well, let me see if I understand your argument. You're not arguing that there's a constitutional right to see a family member.
No.
You are arguing that there is no voluntary waiver of the Miranda rights, or no voluntary confession. Both of those, yeah, voluntary. The standards are a little different. You are arguing that it wasn't voluntary, it wasn't knowing, and it wasn't intelligent as a waiver of the Miranda or as a voluntary statement because she was held incommunicado when, which is not unusual to hold somebody incommunicado, when she asked for her husband, right?
Yes.
When she asked to make a telephone call.
Yes.
And that's not the only circumstances you rely on. If you just relied on that, you probably have a loser. That should instill confidence. I mean, you're putting that in the total context of all the circumstances.
Of course, yeah.
Could I ask you very specifically, in the second stage of the question, were any damaging questions asked before a Miranda warning was given?
The second stage?
When they went to the sheriff's
department. When they went to the sheriff's department? I don't believe there were any responses given before the Miranda warning at the sheriff's department, if I recall correctly.
Okay. Could you specify precisely what the officer said with respect to her right to make a telephone call?
Detective Shapey at about 5:20 that day told Ms. Ward she could not make any telephone calls. Period. He did not.
That's undisputed?
That was his testimony.
Yeah, but there was
let me ask, if I may, how that statement, if we accept that as fact, squares with the Miranda warning.
I don't think it squares with her right to counsel, because taking literally what Detective Shapey told her, she she would know that she would not be able to make a telephone call to counsel. So I think it's a direct violation of Miranda and of the right to counsel to hold somebody incommunicado overnight and not permit them an opportunity to make telephonic contact with a lawyer. Now, in fairness, Detective Shapey did testify that sometime after that, I think he said around 7 o'clock, he talked to another deputy and he instructed the deputy to tell Ms. Ward that phoning her lawyer would be an exception to the blanket rule that he told her, that she couldn't phone anybody. But that deputy didn't testify. We don't know, other than through Detective Shapey's testimony, who said, and he told her that, but we don't know how Detective Shapey knows that, whether he's just assuming that the deputy conveyed that information to her. We don't know when it was conveyed to her, if it was at all. We don't know if that happened at 11 o'clock p.m. We don't know if it happened at midnight. We don't know if it happened far too late for her to...
Didn't the trial court make a finding?
I'm sorry?
Didn't the trial court make a finding as to whether she was told?
I think the court said she was told, yeah.
Sure.
But the court didn't make a finding as to when that happened.
Somewhere between 7...
And the next day.
And the next day she was told. At least the trial court found it. Now, might argue that the record doesn't substantiate.
And I do argue that the record doesn't substantiate that because...
You have a trial court finding against you on that point.
I'm sorry?
You have a trial court finding against you on the point of whether she was told she could call a lawyer.
We have, I believe, a finding that she was told, but no finding as to when that happened. And again, I don't think the record supports that finding because there was no foundation for Detective Shapey's testimony that the deputy told her that. We don't know how... Mm-hmm. How Detective Shapey knows that, whether he was assuming that happened. And if she was told at midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning, it wouldn't have done her much good. Even, I think, the lag between 5:20, when she's told she can't make any calls at all, and sometime after 7 o'clock, where she may have been told she can call a lawyer, that gap in time effectively prevents her from contacting counsel because... Most lawyers aren't in their office answering the telephone after 7 o'clock at night. She might have been able to find one at 5:20 or 5:30. She can only make a collect call from the jail, so calling, if somebody calls my office from the jail at midnight, they get an answering service that won't take a collect call, and I think that's true of most law firms. So if simply telling her you can't make any phone calls for some period of time deprived her of the right to counsel, and I think that vitiates any voluntary waiver of the right to counsel that happened the next day. My light is on.
So you're really just asking for a totality of circumstances case. This is nothing new under the law. You just think the totality here holds in your favor and Hansen it didn't.
That's correct. I think we have a combination here of a number of coercive tactics that weren't present in Hansen. We have the isolation from her family. We have the use of deception. We have the fact that she's being held overnight and refused the phone call. We have a much lengthier interrogation than we had in Hansen. And we have the fact that the detective is continuously insisting that Ms. Ward killed Thomas. And despite her continuously saying, no, I didn't, but then questioning it and saying, well, how did I? What did I do? What are you saying I did? And we see, I think, an evolution of her story from a flat denial in the beginning to basically accepting the suggestions that Detective Shapey is making to her. And I think given that's the way that wrongful confessions occur, we don't have the kind of reliable confession that due process requires.
Thank you, counsel. Is it Newser or Noiser? Is it Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin.
May it please the court, my name is Mark Neuser and I represent the state in this matter. Defendant Jennifer Ward stands convicted of first-degree reckless homicide. The jury found that on December 1, 2004, Ward, who was age 35, caused the death of her 7-week-old nephew named Thomas. There are two issues presented in this case. One, whether Ward's statements to police over the ensuing hours and day were voluntary. And two, whether Ward validly waived her right to counsel before giving her statements to police on the afternoon of December 1st and on the morning of December 2nd. The trial court answered both questions yes. The Court of Appeals answered both questions yes. The state asked this court to do likewise. What the state requests that the court holds is as follows. First of all, on the question of the voluntariness of Ward's statements, the state asks this court to hold as follows. Under the balancing test required by State versus Hoppe, Ward's statements were clearly voluntary. The circuit court found, and the record amply supports, that Ward's personal characteristics do not place her in the category of a person who is uncommonly susceptible to police pressures. Secondly, the police did not exert any undue pressures on her. Number two, on the question of whether Ward validly waived her right to counsel, the state simply asked this court to abide by the rule of stare decisis and to uphold its previous three decisions on this matter, not just one, State versus Hansen, State versus Jones, State versus Corper. These decisions hold that Article 1, Section 8 of the Wisconsin Constitution is coextensive with, not broader than, the protection of the Fifth Amendment. These cases also rely on the U.S. Supreme Court case of Brown versus Burbine to hold that efforts by counsel to contact a suspect who is in custody have no bearing on the validity of that suspect's waiver of her right to counsel. Now, let's turn first to the voluntariness of Ward's statements.
I'd like to turn first to the question that I was asking your opposing counsel.
Yes.
And that is with respect to what the officer told her at the end of the first session of the Sheriff's Department. Did the officer say, you cannot make a telephone call?
The testimony is twofold on this point. At the end of the first questioning session, he did say, we're not going to allow any telephone calls because we are going to be executing a search warrant on your house right now, and we don't want any interference in that process. That was at approximately 5:20 p.m. when the interview concluded. At about 7 p.m., the deputy realized that he needed to extend her the right to speak with a lawyer. So he telephoned the jailer, and the jailer in turn told Ward that she had the right to communicate to a telephone call with counsel. The trial court specifically found it, number one. And there is an explicit factual finding on that point.
That's because of the testimony of Officer Chafee?
It is because of the testimony of Officer Chafee, and it's also because of a statement, I believe, that's contained in the transcript of the interview session the following morning. As you recall, Ward requested that police come to see her and that she have another conversation with them. And during the course of that questioning, she did not disagree with Detective Chafee's statement that she had been given the opportunity to call an attorney the previous night. Chafee said, you know that you were given that opportunity last night, and here is Ward's answer. She said, she first of all did not say, no, that's not true. What she said was, I didn't have an attorney, and I didn't know who to call, and usually they're gone by that time. So she herself does not dispute in the transcript of the interview session that she was given the right to a phone call to a lawyer. Moreover, I would also add that it's not as though there are any statements that are in the record from her during that overnight period. She is the one who initiated contact with the police the following morning. She was Mirandized again before she gave any other statements. And in fact, as the police were about to Mirandize her, she said, if I wasn't willing to talk with you, why would we be in here? So she knew her rights and that her statements were voluntary. Returning, if I may, to the voluntariness of her statements.
Mr. Neuser, before you do that, maybe you could clarify something else for me. My understanding is that her husband hired a lawyer. The lawyer came to the jail, perhaps to the hospital too, but at least to
no,
the jail.
No, not the hospital, the jail.
And the lawyer requested on more than one occasion to talk to the defendant. Is that all correct?
That's correct.
And do you see that as a factor entering into the totality of the circumstances?
No, I do not.
That, why?
Because that is a factor that is extrinsic to Ward's decision to voluntarily waive her right to counsel. And again, this goes back to what the Burbine court has said. The Burbine court said it's a non-factor. And I believe this court, in all three of the decisions that I mentioned earlier, the Hansen case, the Jones case, and the Corper case, also said it's a non-factor. And the reason for that is because Miranda explicitly states what a suspect needs to be told. The suspect needs to be told that he or she has a right to an attorney, then an attorney will be provided if the suspect can't afford one, that the suspect can get counsel at any time during the interrogation, and that the interrogation will cease at any time the suspect deny or requests counsel. The law doesn't and should not require that police inform a suspect of the relative ease by which the right to counsel can be exercised.
You remember a U.S. Supreme Court decision prior to Miranda called Escobedo?
I do not.
That's unfortunate.
How old are you?
Maybe when you're done here, you should go back and read Escobedo. In my recollection of Escobedo, and I understand that Escobedo certainly has been somewhat altered, perhaps, by the Miranda decision, which was subsequent to Escobedo. But I know that the U.S. Supreme Court in Escobedo expressed concern, major concern, with what had occurred there in keeping a defendant basically incommunicado. And when you tell me that an attorney waiting, asking to talk to his client, that he's been hired to represent, that that's all extraneous to the totality of the circumstances, that pushes it beyond what I can accept. It certainly, to me, is at least a factor that has to be considered in the totality of the circumstances.
Well,
now tell me why it's not a factor and it's just totally extraneous because of Burbine.
Well, first of all, the Burbine court disagreed, as did this court, Hansen, Jones, and the other case that I mentioned. So stare decisis.
Disagreed with what?
Disagreed with the idea that the failure of police to tell a suspect that an attorney is present and waiting to talk to him or her is a factor in the totality of the circumstances.
That's what you're saying. That's what you say.
Right.
That's the way you interpret that.
That's the way I interpret them. I think the Burbine court's biggest fear is that if we were to consider that as a factor in the totality of the circumstances, you really would start to develop two different sets of suspects. Those of those who are fortunate enough or well-connected enough or privileged enough to happen to have an attorney show up at the jailhouse and request to speak with him or her, and those who are not so fortunate. And in those two separate circumstances, you can have the exact same interrogation techniques, exact same waivers of Miranda, all of that, but due to factors extraneous to the defendant, to the suspect. One suspect's waiver will be seen to be voluntary, the other suspect will be seen to be not voluntary.
The state can handle that. Just have a public defender on call automatically. Someone gets arrested, he's in the jail, she's in the jail. And so we treat rich and poor alike.
Well, I'm not prepared to concede from a budgetary standpoint that the state can handle that. And secondly, I think as the trial court pointed out, it's not too much, I think, to ask of a defendant to say four words, "I want a lawyer." And it's done.
Well,
questioning stops.
I wanna read some things from the transcript of the second interview. This is the one that Justice Prosser asked. Did the people who were interrogating Jennifer ask any not appropriate questions? Okay, inappropriate questions.
I'm sorry, I have these transcripts with me. Could you refer
to them? I have the transcripts with me, too. We're both very fortunate. Page 34.
Page 34 of the second question session? Okay.
Got it? It's Defendant's Exhibit Number 16, the way I've got it here. Got it?
Yeah.
All right. Page 34. And he's saying to her that he's really just trying to get to the bottom of all this, mm-hmm. and that little Thomas wants us to get to the bottom of it. So she says she's JLW, right? That's her middle initial is
yes,
L.
Yes, yes.
The questioner is JW.
Mm-hmm.
They don't make these things easy for us.
Right, it's James Wood.
Right, Jennifer L. Wood. Yeah, yes. Right. Took me a long time to figure that out. And then so the questioner says, maybe you're just clinging to her or rubbing to her. He's really trying to be helpful to her. And she responds, that's what I'm thinking I did. And then Jennifer says, because that's the only explanation I got. And then they go on explaining that he vomited and she took him into the bathroom. And then he says to her, Jennifer, you probably ticked off. If you're like me, when I get up with my infant, and I have a one-year-old right now, I know exactly where you're sitting, and it's frustrating, especially if you've got back problems. And she says she has back problems. But again, what I'm going to tell you is I need to find out from you, and I need you to explain, because I don't see anything that says you went after this child intentionally, right? And she says, no, I love him. And he says, and if you love him, then you got to help. You got to help put an end to what happened. And she says, and I'm trying to. That's why I'm here with you guys. They're all very helpful to each other. And then he says, when you're washing him, Jennifer, show me, describe to me what happened. It was something that happened. If you think that's when it happened, and you didn't intend for it to happen, describe to me. I mean, when you were washing him, do you have him in your arm and you're doing other things? What I will tell you, though, is this is enough shaking that causes damage that there's no other excuse. You're right. You're not bad. So she cries, and she says, no, I'm not. And he says, you're not a bad person. And she cries, I killed my nephew. And he says, you're not a bad person, though, Jennifer. You didn't mean to do it. Do you know what I mean? She's crying. That makes me bad, because I basically took a life. But you didn't intend to, says the officer. There's a difference. She's crying. No, taking a life is taking a life. He says, well, she's still crying. She says, you get punished no matter what. And he says, well, I don't even worry about punishment. And then they take it from there. And then he says, tell me what happened. That's whatever you're doing, Jennifer, is enough. And I can tell you care enough about Thomas. Don't let little Thomas go without an explanation. You're an adult. And you know, yeah, I did something that's not good, but you can. That's what I've been trying to get to, Glenn. And like I asked him, it looked like he was mad at me, and it's like, he says he's not. I don't know who they're all talking about. But anyway, it gets frustrating. I talk to the girls. Neither of us, the girls are her children, I gather. Neither of us think that you did this intentionally. And then she says, I wouldn't do that. So he is just always asking her what she did, right?
Right.
And telling her that somehow she must have done something because the baby would not be dead if she wouldn't do anything. Isn't that the whole tenor of this conversation?
That's true. I mean, he had already established at the hospital that she had been the sole person in care of the infant for the previous 5 days. He had been told by the ER doctor and by a radiologist that this was a shaken baby. So I think it was fair to him to press her on what could have happened to this baby to have caused bleeding on the brain. I don't think that's an inappropriate question.
It's good, probably good interrogation. It probably would meet any of the standards for interrogation. Might be even used as a model of how to get somebody to talk.
I feel a trap door being closed around
me. She. You feel trapped? You're a lawyer. And didn't she feel trapped?
Well,
that's my point.
Again, I mean, I think that the courts have for many, many years been willing to live with all sorts of, put this in air quotes, evils, to convince a suspect to confess, including outright deception.
That's right. And I agree with you, counsel. Your answer is perfect. I agree with you. The courts have accepted this kind of questioning. You're not done, though.
I'm just done, but I'm putting this away. So
right. Counselor, I have a question that just troubles me. Is there anything in the record about the infant's retinas and the damage to the infant's retinas, or is it just the bleeding that was on the brain, some of which was new and some of which was old?
Justice Rogosek, I'm not entirely sure I can give you a good answer to that.
Okay, we don't know. That's a fair answer, too. Thank you. Are we going to look at the evidence to see if it's sufficient? Is that an issue? No.
No.
The only thing an issue is voluntary. Okay, got it. Counsel, what import was our case State versus Gerald that was decided in 2005? That involved juvenile, and I'm just, in case you don't have an immediate recollection, it involved a juvenile, and Gerald was in custody, and several times he asked if he could make a phone call to his mother or father, and each time Detective Spano said no. Spano later testified that never in his 12 years did he allow a juvenile to contact parents during interrogation because it could stop the flow or jeopardize it altogether. And here before us in this court, Gerald asked the court to adopt a per se rule that before a juvenile is questioned and can give incriminating evidence, that a per se rule should be adopted that children under the age of 16 should be allowed to call their parents or have their parents present when they're interrogated in this kind of a situation. And we said, no, we're not, the majority said, no, we're not going to abandon totality of circumstances. We like totality of circumstances tests, and we embrace it. We're not going to take your per se rule regarding consultation with a parent or interested adult. But we then concluded and said this. Instead, we choose to reaffirm our warning in a case called Theorold, which we said that the failure to call the parents for the purpose of depriving the juvenile of the opportunity to receive advice and counsel will be considered, quote, strong evidence that coercive tactics were used to elicit the incriminating statements. That was a quote from Theorold, which we again cited with approval in Gerald. And so why isn't some of this stuff at least, if not strong evidence of coercive tactics, at least a factor to be considered in the totality of circumstances? Wanted to call husband hampered with that. Why isn't that something we can consider?
Well, I would say that the Gerald case is limited to its facts involving a juvenile. Let's turn the page and look at Jennifer Ward for a moment. 35 years old, completed high school. Her father is a police officer for the California Highway Patrol. She knew her Miranda rights from memory. She was verbally sophisticated enough to engage in semantics games with the police officers. And also, this response to a point that opposing counsel raised, this wasn't her first go-round in the criminal justice system, and in fact, there is testimony from Jennifer that she was familiar with the police interview process.
Let me ask more pointedly, is the request to call her husband, I think repeated request, and the hampering of that a factor to consider in the totality of circumstances?
No, it's a non-factor.
Why would it be in the juvenile case not just a factor, but we said strong evidence that coercive tactics were used to elicit the incriminating statements, and it's not even a factor in the totality of circumstances when it's an adult?
The law extends additional protections to juveniles. Here we have an intelligent adult who had been informed her rights very clearly and knew them by heart.
Well, let's say this adult was 18 rather than 16. Then, but all the other facts are the same.
Mm-hmm.
We have 11 and 12-year-old children, but close enough to the facts. Could we say that the request to call her husband was a factor in the totality of the circumstances?
No, I don't think so. I think Miranda is self-contained. She was informed as required by the Miranda court, and the law requires nothing further for an adult.
You don't want to see this court have a per se rule, an absolute rule, if they ask to see somebody or consult with somebody about the right to counsel, that questioning has to stop. I mean, that's what I heard Mr. Kelly say.
It's absolutely not.
You have no authority. You found no authority supporting Mr. Kelly, did you?
I found no authority supporting Attorney Kelly whatsoever.
Okay. So we can, Justice Bradley says, I'm reading into your statement, in effect, I won't go that far and say, hey, she wants to talk to her mother, her brother, her husband, you got to stop it. But isn't that one factor to look at the whole circumstance in these three questioning as to whether she has been voluntarily, knowing, and intelligently made a confession or waived her rights?
Well, it's slightly troubling to say that if police say, no, you can't talk to your husband, your wife, your child, your co-conspirator, for all I know, that's a strike against counsel in the voluntariness balancing. There are very good reasons to prevent a suspect from making those types of telephone calls, as evidenced by this very case. They're executing a search warrant at her home on the evening of December 1st. It was a very logical thing for a police officer to do, to say, you can't call your husband right now. They're worried about interference with evidence. That's legitimate.
Counsel, did she say, I want to make a phone call because I don't know if I want to invoke my right to a lawyer and I need to talk to my husband before I decide?
I believe her expressions of reticence were expressed the following morning on December 2nd, saying, well, that's why I was saying yesterday, I kind of wanted to talk to my husband. And in fact, Detective Chafee made clear, if you read the transcript of the interview, that she never expressly said that. I want to talk to my husband right now. Stop. Time out.
I'm getting the impression from some of the questions, and I need to sort this out in my own mind, that she was told you can't make a phone call, and she's saying, I need to talk to someone. I can't decide if I should talk to you. Please let me make a phone call. And they say no.
I don't think that's the case at all, actually. The detective said no phone calls tonight, later on clarified to say you may call an attorney, and the next morning she's the one who initiated contact with police without making any phone calls whatsoever.
Since she's Miranda, she must be in custody, right?
She is in custody.
Okay, so what are the rules that law enforcement plays by when someone's in custody? Do they get to make unfettered telephone calls to whomever they want, whenever they want,
No.
under whatever circumstances they'd like?
No. You know, in fact, I think one could argue that whether or not she was allowed to call an attorney that night is irrelevant. There are no statements from that night that my opposing counsel seeks to suppress. She spent the night in jail. She woke up the next morning. She asked to speak to police. They Mirandized her. She said, well, if I wasn't willing to talk, why would we be in here? So I frankly see it as almost a non-issue. Returning back just to respond to a point opposing counsel made, a lot has been said about Jennifer Ward's physical and mental condition while in the hospital, including the seizure that she suffered. I think it's important, as this does factor into the equation of whether statements were voluntarily made at the hospital or not, for the court to know a little bit more background about her medical condition. The term seizure was only used by a police officer who was first responding to the scene. The trial court found, as a specific fact, that there is no real proof that Ward's medical problems made her particularly vulnerable. Of course, it's now Ward's obligation on appeal to show that that was a clearly erroneous finding of fact, and I would submit that she has not done so. In fact, at trial, the court asked Ward, in your estimation, have you had some sort of seizure? Ward's answer, I don't know. That's what nobody was telling me. If Ward herself can't testify under oath that she had a seizure, then certainly the trial court's finding is not in error. So, to conclude, the state asked the court to hold two things. First of all, the statements were voluntary. And secondly, we simply request that the court adhere to the principles of stare decisis. Adhere to the Hansen case, adhere to the Jones case, adhere to the Corporate case, and hold that her waiver of her Miranda rights were knowing, voluntary, and intelligent. And barring any other questions, my yellow light is on.
So from your standpoint, this is a straight Warren versus Burbine State v. Hansen case, isn't it?
Yes. Yes.
And you just want the court to apply that law. And that you got a defendant who is 35, has had experience with criminal law, has been questioned for, what, 5-6 hours on the day right part of which the offense took place, kept overnight in jail. She asked for questioning again. That's a very important factor. There is no sign of any browbeating here. Just good questioning, repeated and pointed, to get her to say what happened.
Right.
So I'm putting ideas in her head that this could happen with shaking.
That's a permissible thing to do.
Yeah, that's really the point of my questioning, counsel, that everything here can be supported in one case or other as perfectly acceptable questioning, including deception.
Right.
And that the courts have viewed that it is important to get people to admit and confess. In fact, most crimes are solved through confession rather than CSI. Is that the name of the program?
Mm-hmm.
Rather than CSI technical kinds of stuff. And that that's acceptable in there. Society.
Under the law as it stands in both the U.S. Supreme Court and this court, everything that was done here is acceptable. Period.
Why do you think the court took this case? Beats you, huh? Beats me, too. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Kelly, why do you think we took this case? Stand in front of the microphone, please.
hope you took it to reverse.
Well said. Now you have to persuade the court for Brown's, because it's hard to pinpoint anything that happened here that wasn't accepted in some case or other.
I agree with that, Your Honor, and I think the difficulty here is that if you isolate each factor, yes, you can say that factor is something that the police are allowed to do, or this is something that doesn't by itself lead to an involuntary confession. But when you examine the totality of the circumstances, which is what I think the state neglects to do and what I think the trial court neglected to do, and the Court of Appeals, you have the combination of a person who has just gone through a very traumatic experience, a person who is insisting that she needs to speak to her family members in order to be able to make a determination of whether she should waive her right to counsel, a person who is being interrogated in different locations over a lengthy period of time over the course of 2 days, who is being interrogated using deceptive tactics, who is being interrogated using tactics that essentially cause her story to evolve from "I didn't do anything" to "well, what did I do or how could I have done that" to eventually I must have killed him. I think if you look at the totality of all of those circumstances, the conclusion here, and it's a legal conclusion, it's not a factual conclusion to which any deference is owed any other court, is that this was not a voluntary confession, and it certainly wasn't a voluntary waiver of the right to counsel. There are a couple of points here that I want to clarify, but I think...
Kelly, let me interrupt you for just a minute. Do you think that your reading of Irvine and Hansen stops this court from having the ability to look at these various factors? For instance, the attorney waiting to talk to his client, the client wanting to call her husband. Are we forbidden from considering those things? That's what I understood your opposing counsel was arguing.
I think Burdine would say that the fact that an attorney has been retained for her that she doesn't know about is not an appropriate factor, because her voluntary decision can't be affected by something she doesn't know about. That's very different from her saying, "I want to talk to my husband." She knows what she wants. She wants more information so that she can make an intelligent decision whether to exercise her right to remain silent or her right to have counsel. And the detective is foreclosing her from getting that information. He's not allowing her to get the assistance that she needs. So that's a completely different situation than we had in Burdine. In fact, I think it's exactly the opposite. This is a person who knows what information she needs, and the police are preventing her from getting that information. When opposing counsel...
Mr. Kelly, one of the underpinnings of Burdine, in addition to the absence of personal knowledge, was the court, as my understanding is, re-emphasizing or noting that the right to counsel is a personal right and cannot, under the law, be asserted on behalf of someone. It has to be invoked by the individual, him or herself. Is that a fair statement?
Yes.
And the reason why, and it kind of comes full circle, it's interesting because this is where you and I started our brief colloquy at the beginning of this hearing, which is the reason why it strikes me as a fluid movement in the constitutional law to say that it must be considered as a factor that someone else should be consulted as to whether or not the decision should be made to invoke your own personal right to counsel. Doesn't that seem to take it away from the individual? Doesn't that seem to give to, in this instance, the husband a shared or a co-equal right to the counsel that it seems to me is a bit in opposite to the Burdine holding? That was my point.
No, not at all, Your Honor.
I didn't expect you really to agree with me, Mr. Kelly. But I'd like to know a little more why.
Because individuals who make personal decisions don't make them in a vacuum. They make them on the basis of the best information they can get. That doesn't mean that they are foreclosed from consulting other people. I mean, if I decide that, if I'm thinking about getting married, that's a personal decision on my part, but I might ask my parents.
It doesn't foreclose it. It doesn't foreclose it. For instance, if she had been held in custody in a jail cell as opposed to a hospital or someplace else, she could have conferred with one of her cellmates. Doesn't foreclose the opportunity, but that's a different thing from saying that she's got the right for that consequence.
Well, again, I'm not saying she has a right to do that.
You're saying it's a factor.
I'm saying it's a factor that needs to be considered. And when the police know that she wants to consult not with a stranger who happens to be a cellmate, but with her husband, who she's known and loved for many years, and the police say, no, you can't do that, that's a factor. When opposing counsel argues that police have a very good, or may have a very good reason for denying somebody access to a husband or a family member or whoever, I think we need to look at the record in this case. Detective Chaffee's very good reason is he knew that, based on his conversation with the husband, that if she talked with the husband would say, get a lawyer and don't talk until you have a lawyer. And he admitted that on page 67 of the suppression hearing transcript.
Sure, and there was nothing inconsistent with the known law in what he did.
He was allowed to do that, but the fact that he did it is a factor that I think weighs heavily against the argument that she made a knowing and intelligent decision to waive counsel when the detective is depriving her of the ability to get the information she wants in order to make an intelligent decision. The other point that I think is important is that I hear opposing counsel saying, you know, on the second day she initiated contact with Detective Chaffee. On page 66 of the suppression transcript, you'll see that she initiated contact with Chaffee to ask him, can I call my husband now? And she says, also on that second day, the reason I wanted to call my husband is so that I could make this decision about whether I should be talking to you at all or whether I should have a lawyer.
And then she keeps talking.
And then she keeps talking.
So
because
this is a very convoluted kind of record, which they all are when you get to this.
Sure.
That there are pointers in all directions. One supporting that she really doesn't want to talk. But when the conversations continue, she does want to talk. Does she stand her ground and say, I'm not saying another word until I talk to my husband? No. Does she stand her ground and say, I'm not going to talk to you until I talk to a lawyer? No. So the conversations keep going, and over, I spared you my dramatic reading of the third, but in the third one, over and over they say, tell us what you want. Not in exactly those words. I want to talk? You don't want to talk. One, and she talks, then she doesn't, and it's constant. And they don't have to stop talking just because she can't make up her mind what she wants to do, right?
That's true. Although I think it is also some evidence that she is not a strong-willed person, the fact that she keeps talking. And I think that goes to her personal characteristics.
I know, but you can't make rules for strong-willed and weaker-willed persons, although you're supposed to look at the individual. But she is 35. She has had experience with criminal law. She comes from a background relating to law enforcement, so she may not be as frightened or concerned as other people might. And you put all that together, right? Including incommunicado.
Yes. And I think those factors, though, I mean, the fact that she wants to talk to her husband and expressly says over and over, I want to talk to my husband about this decision, shows that, like the juvenile in the Gerald case, she is a person who is particularly susceptible to these interrogation tactics, and she's trying to get the support of a family member who will help her think through this decision and make a correct decision. So I think under the facts of this case, if you look at the totality of the circumstances, I think it's not a voluntary decision to talk or to waive counsel. I don't think we want to have the kind of society in which the police are allowed to bring all of these pressures to bear upon a person who is, I think, very clearly, or should have been very clearly obvious to the officer, was having a lot of trouble making this decision, was reaching out and trying to get help, and have a situation which the police say, no, you're not allowed to get any help, and then say, oh, but that's fine. She made a voluntary and intelligent and free decision. I don't think that's the real world. And I think when you look at the studies that I cited in my briefs about the number of wrongful convictions that are traced to false confessions, this is exactly the kind of circumstance in which you would expect a false confession. You have a police officer who's done no particular investigation at all, who is focused with tunnel vision on getting this woman to confess, and over the course of time, he eventually gets her to adopt his view of what happened, even though that view isn't particularly consistent with the physical evidence in the case. I think under all of these circumstances, if the ultimate question is, we require voluntariness in order to assure the reliability of the confession. If you're asking, under all of these circumstances, was this a reliable confession? It wasn't.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly, and thank you, Mr. Noiser, for your arguments in yet another question of voluntary confession case. The court is concludes its argument in 07AP79CR, State versus Board. Justice Bradley will be out shortly to talk to this group of students and others. And if counsel would approach the bench, please. The court's in recess. The court will meet again at 1:50, 1 hour for lunch, 20 minutes to look at these cases in our usual fashion, and then 1:50.